The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, thank you so much for being here today, continuing in the series of Jesus Mad or Majestic. I am the light of the world. I'm not the light of the world, but Jesus. We'll talk about Jesus being the light of the world here in just a moment. Ian Powell is our speaker today for the 2020 Vision Series, seeing Jesus' life clearly. There's definitely some compelling things going on here in John chapter 8. And if you have questions, write them down on a small slip of paper. Jamie will come up and come around the tables and be able to pick up the slips of paper, and Ian will take time after the talk today and after some other announcements be able to answer those. We will do some announcements here later, but if you want to go ahead and open up to John chapter 8 here in the outline, I'm going to start at the sentence mark number 12, and then we'll have Ian come on up. When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." The Pharisees challenged him. "Here you are, appearing as your own witness, and your testimony is not valid." Jesus answered, "Even if I testify on my own behalf, my testimony is valid, for I know where I came from and where I am going. But you have no idea where I come from or where I am going. As you judge by human standards, I pass judgment on no one. But if I do judge, my decisions are true, because I am not alone. I stand with the Father who sent me. In your own law, it is written that the testimony of two witnesses is true. I am one who testifies for myself, and my other witness is the Father who sent me." Then they asked him, "Where is your Father?" "You do not know me or my Father," Jesus replied. "If you knew me, you would know my Father also." Ian.
Good afternoon. Well, I've been trying to work out what I should do today, whether or not, since we've known each other for some time, I could be honest with you. And I figured on the basis of, you know, telling the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, I'd just share some stuff with you that I don't normally share. And if you're not normally here, good luck. You're here on a great time, because the fact of the matter is, though later you might be aware of it, when you hear my voice, you're actually hearing the voice of God. If you want to know what God is like, look back further than me. If you're interested in the way of God, lots of discussion about that as well. I am the way of God. And apart from me, there is no other way. If you're interested in truth, not a set of propositions, I am the truth. I am the grand unified theory. Science is all. If you're interested in light and all its fullness, I am light. Know me, be one of my friends, is to know life in all its fullness. To be away from me is death. On the judgment day, the one question that the world exam paper will be about your friendship, your relationship with me. That's all my Father is interested. I've come from him, I'll return to him. You're from the earth, I'm from above. I am the light of the world. If you're interested in light, walking in the light as against the darkness, if you follow me, you walk in the light. You'll never walk in the darkness. Then now, I don't know what you expect to have at your lunchtime break, a bit of a chat about God. But today it's far better than that. This is really breaking news. Now, they are, because the sort of statements, I ripped them all out of the mouth of Jesus. That is what Jesus says about himself and more. As we saw last week, he says, "Are you hungry?" There is a longing in all of us for more than just existence, but for life. Jesus says, "I am the bread of life." In John 7, he says, "Are you thirsty? I am the water." And then in John 8, he says, "I am the light of the world. Verse 12. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. This is a staggering claim, in a sense a shattering claim. He finishes up this chapter with another claim where he just says, before Abraham was, that's roughly 2,000 years before Jesus was walking around the earth, before Abraham was, I am. As we saw last week, the personal name of God revealed to Moses. Who shall I say send me, says Moses. Tell them I am has sent you. Jesus, before Abraham was, I am. And the end result of that, if you look that up in your own Bible, if you take one of the ones that's here for free, is that they take up stones to kill him. They know exactly what he's saying, these people that he is initially communicating to. So let's look firstly at his claim, then their challenge, then they're in our crisis in our few minutes together. So as you heard in verse 12, they're the first statement read. Jesus, well, look at what it says. When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said. Now, so this is clearly not the first thing Jesus said. This is part of a story, a narrative, which begins way back in chapter 7. So the last time Jesus had spoken to the people, generally, is in chapter 7, verse 37. That's the very last time before that. In between, that's one little personal interchange. And most of it in the end of chapter 7 is people talking about Jesus, trying to work out what to do with Jesus. But verse 37, he says this, or John says, on the last and greatest day of the festival, Jesus stood and said in a loud voice, let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. So this is all happening in a great festival. Well, what sort of festival is it? Well, if you go back to chapter 7, verse 1, it will tell you. Verse 2, when he gets invited to go up to the festival, verse 2, the Jewish festival of Tabernacles was near. Ah, so this is the festival that Jesus is speaking on the last greatest day of the festival, the festival of Tabernacles. I don't know if you know what happens in the festival of Tabernacles, but this is one of the three great feasts or festive occasions that all the Jews were supposed to, no matter where they lived, they were supposed to come up to Jerusalem to celebrate in the temple. This is one of the three big ones, the Feast of the Tabernacles. Now, I ran into the Feast of the Tabernacles growing up in Rose Bay. On the houses on one behind us, one on each side, we had a Greek family on one side, and then actually an Italian family, then a Greek family, and then two Jewish families, one on one side of us and one at the back of us. And playing cricket, very often we'd be climbing over the fence to get the balls back. Not so much football, that just broke all the bushes. But I remember one afternoon, it was a magnificent hit. Over the fence it had gone and climbed over the wall and down. I was looking on the two levels of their backyard. And there in the middle of it was this sort of fairly official-looking cubby house thing. And it had some greenery on it. And I looked at it. It didn't look as if it was made by kids. And the neighbours stuck their head out. And they were quite happy for us looking for the ball. And I said, hey, what's with the little house? And they explained it was the Festival of Booths, which is sometimes also called. It's the Festival of Tabernacles, where the Jewish people are commanded in the Old Testament and continue to do to this day, they build tabernacles, that is, little tents, little booths, little cubby houses, is what it seemed to me. And for about a week or so, they live and have part of their life in this little tabernacle. They eat their meals there, they say their prayers there. What's all that about? Well, the Feast of the Tabernacles was, at one level, a Thanksgiving festival. It was at the end of harvest time. It was a Thanksgiving that all good gifts come from God. And it was also a reminder of the great gift that God gave, which was what? Well, the great gift God gave Israel that defined them was the rescue out of Egypt, the Passover, also celebrating the Feast of what they called Unleavened Bread. But the Tabernacle in particular remembered those 40 years when God led and guided and provided for his people as they wandered in the wilderness, in the desert. And he looked after them and shielded them from warring tribes and shielded them from starvation and thirst. And this was celebrated in the Feast of the Tabernacles. This is when Jesus says this statement. And I think this is significant in just picking up the particular angle Jesus brings in on this question of light. I am the light of the world. Each day for the 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles, there was a very big ritual about water. I won't bore you with the details, but it was a very big procession, gold, water poured all over the temple. And it's in that context on the last day when the last of the water festivities have been done, that's when Jesus says in chapter 7, the statement before this one, on the last and greatest day of the festival, the sort of temple awash with water, reminding them that God had provided for water even in the desert, which is quite a feat. Jesus says, talking about thirst, is anyone thirsty? Come to me and drink. I'm the source of living water, as he says in John 4. And then at the end of it, when Jesus again spoke to the people, again on the last and great day, he says, I'm the light of the world. What's this about? Well, some of you may know that what used to happen in the temple in those days, each night they would light these huge, I mean, as tall as this building, huge candlesticks, candelabras. I don't know what you call candles when they're that big, but they were just monstrous things. And it was said by people who'd visited Jerusalem at the Feast of the Tabernacles that the light from these huge candles, many of them that they lit, kind of glowed out of the temple and sort of covered the whole of Jerusalem. It was a massive festival of water and light that lies behind this. And let me read you from the Mishnah, that's a Jewish writing from the time, about what happened with these four huge lamps. They had four separate lamps that they lit. And it just says this, from chapter 5 of Sukkah. Towards the end of the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, people went down into the court of the women. The Jewish temple was divided into the court of the Gentiles, the women, the men, the priests. So this is the one where all the Jews would be together. That's where most of the sacrifices took place, in what was called the court of the women, where the whole of the Israelite nation could be. Golden lamps were there, and four golden bowls were on each of them, and four ladders were by them. You got any candlesticks for your dinner table that you need ladders for? Well, these ones, they had ladders. Four young men from the priests had jugs of oil in their hands containing about 30 litres, and they poured oil from them into each individual bowl. The wicks were made from discarded priests' trousers and from their belts. There was no courtyard in Jerusalem that was not bright from the light from the temple. Men of piety and known for their good works danced before the crowd with torches in their hands and sang before them songs of praises. Each night they danced until the dawn came. The pious sought not to sleep any night of this festival. Okay, so it's all about light. And they're dancing, and they're partying, and they're celebrating, and the priests are playing zithers and all sorts of other things. It was a great celebration of what? Of light. Well, not just light. I mean, light is a thing to be thankful for. I just bought that new book by the Bryson character, which indicates he thinks the great invention in human history is the electric light bulb. He argues, and I think factually, that you have more light in your fridge when you open it than most houses had in their main room. We have little idea how easy life is with light. And you'll know that so much of Europe and England's problems with burnings and fires is that has been trying to get sensible light in that half of life that was in darkness. And Jesus, this is a celebration of light, but not just any old light, which is symbolic of all sorts of things in human life. It's symbolic of the particular light that was around in the wanderings in the wilderness, which is what? Well, it's the pillar of fire, which in the daytime was cloaked in clouds so they could see it easily, etc. The pillar of fire that first turns up in Exodus 14 when they've left Egypt and God is directing them where to go, and the Egyptians repent of their decision to let the Israelites go. They send their army out both to kill and to bring back, and the Israelites are frightened. They're just slave people. They don't have an army. They've got the water on one side and this Egyptian army coming behind them. And this fiery pillar, in which, in a sense, sometimes it is hinted that God himself dwelt. The glory of God was in this pillar. It went between the Israelites, who were weak and pathetic, and the Egyptians, who were strong and competent. And it kept the Egyptians at bay. The very first thing that the pillar does, it saves the Israelites from being slaughtered while God is in the process overnight of parting the Red Sea, because it describes how God did that, which took him a night to do with the wind, etc., etc. But we can talk about that some other time. So the first thing that the pillar of fire does is it saves Israel from being destroyed or re-enslaved, or being de-saved. And then in Numbers chapter 9 and other places, it's very clear that what happened was then they wandered through the desert, having been kept safe through the pillar and then through the water. They then wander north or south or east or west or loop the loops or figure eights, whatever they're doing, entirely dependent on what? On the wisdom of Moses? No. On where the pillar of fire went. The pillar of fire went north, they went north. The pillar of fire went east, they went east. if it retraced its steps, they retraced the steps. And we're told in Numbers 9 that if the pillar of fire stayed in a place, stopped, and they, okay, this is where we're camping, and if it left early the next morning, they all packed up and left and followed it. If it stayed for a week, they stayed for a week. It was their guide. It was how God said, this is where we're going, boys. Safety is found this way, not that way. Life and provision and water is found this way. So this is what the pillar of fire was doing. This is what the lights were about. This is why the great celebration was, that God had led his people by this great light, this fiery light. And on the end of it, when the festival is over and the candles have been put out for the last time till the next year, Jesus says, I am the light. I am everything that's symbolized by what you've been doing. But not just the light for the people of Israel. I am the light of the world. Not I am a light for the world. There are a number of different lights you can use. Now Jesus says the world is in darkness. And I am the light of the world. I am the unique light. This is a big claim, isn't it? It's little wonder in the end that those who chose not to believe it found this man unbearable up close. It's only when you've got Jesus so far off in the distance and you're back towards him and you make up a Jesus in your own image that fits into your previous belief systems that Jesus is kind of nice and ignorable. When you come up close, you either fall at his feet or you try to kill him. You either follow him or you fight him, as we'll see happens in John 8 and all the way through the gospel and all the way through to 2010 in Sydney. He makes wonderful claims, that not for his own ego. This isn't like Muhammad Ali, who says, I am the greatest, presumably not because he wants to do us any great service, because he wants his place in history. When Jesus says, I am the light of the world, he's not saying it so he can have some ego trip, but it's because he knows you're in the darkness and you need light. And you will often follow counterfeit light. We're all looking for life and safety and for good wisdom and guidance on how to live. We're all looking for that, consciously or not. And Jesus says his view is darkness. I'm the light. It's a bit like as we looked a few months ago that John 3:16, the most famous verse in the Bible, assumes perishing until he comes as eternal life. This is what Jesus says. And we know from earlier in John, say for example in John 3, a set of verses that really shape my thinking all the time now, where Jesus says, this is how the judgment works. Light has come into the world, but people prefer the darkness to the light. God has sent the light. We actually prefer darkness to light. As Jesus says in John 7, the world hates me, because I bear witness to it that it does evil deeds. The people who shoot at light are criminals, aren't they? Well, of course, unless you're an Allied invasion force and it's the Nazis. Because light is inconvenient, isn't it? If you've got plans and you don't want to be seen and found out, you shoot the light, you kill the light, which is what we did to Jesus. And what we've done repeatedly to people who genuinely represented him. The light is not always welcome, although we desperately long for it in other situations. So that's Jesus' huge claim here. I am the light of the world. And if you follow me, you won't walk in the darkness, but you'll have the light of life. Then what follows, secondly, is their interesting and somewhat valid challenge to his claim in verse 13. The Pharisees, although Jesus speaks to all the people, the Pharisees challenge him. Here you are appearing as your own witness. Your testimony is not valid. So they say, listen, this is just big talk. You're just talking about yourself. That's not valid in our court system. They had to have two or three witnesses, the law of Moses said. And there's a validity about this. See, when I got up and... Oh, by the way, I didn't believe any of those claims I said at the beginning. If you were there at the beginning, I didn't want you to think I really thought that. I haven't finally tipped over the edge of insanity and extreme narcissism, etc. Just in case you thought, what's going on here? Is this guy putting himself up with Jesus? No, I'm an idiot. I'm not there. But Jesus isn't sort of just saying it out of nowhere. He's been with them for some time now, probably or at least a year. And they have seen him do miracles and signs. And they have, both his enemies and his friends and the crowd that is confused. Because if you read through chapter 7, one of the themes in the chapter, this whole, in the tabernacle, is there's all these comments about Jesus. What are we to make of him? They say at one point, he's a good man. Others say, no, he's a deceiver. Others say he's demon-possessed and a Samaritan, which are two of the foulest swear words a good Jewish person could give you. You're a Samaritan. Right? You're a manly supporter. Something like that. So there's that sort of vile put-down. You're a Samaritan and you're demon-possessed. Not very complimentary. But some of them say, well, hang on. They say in verse 31, when the Messiah comes, can he do more miracles than this man has done? So there's this whole discussion, and Jesus hasn't just laid this on them out of nowhere. They've already heard him say, I'm the bread of life. They've seen him feed 5,000 men in the wilderness. They've seen him heal a man who was crippled for 38 years. It's a long time, 38 years. My sister was in a wheelchair for many years, and after only 2 or 3 years, she told me that even if they repaired the electronic cabling in her neck, she was never going to walk again just because of the muscle wastage. So if you've been a cripple for 38 years, even if it's psychosomatic, right, you can have any sort of fuzzy faith healing you like. You're never walking again. They'd seen these things. They had evidence. They'd actually had this same argument in chapter 5. And Jesus gave them 5 lines of witness that they were apart from his own word. Here he just refers to one, because he's had this discussion with these clowns before. And as you heard, really talks about my Father. Verse 10. I am the one who testifies for myself. My other witness is the Father who sent me. He says, the Father, he's also bearing witness. And you're hearing him in your heart. The fact that it doesn't make sense to dismiss me as demon-possessed or as a liar and a deceiver or even just as a good man. He makes big claims. They throw out the challenge. Where is your validifying evidence? Which is why, again and again, Christians say, they said it to me before I became a Christian, have you read a gospel since you became an adult? And I've been asking that question around the city for a while now, and I find almost nobody who isn't a Christian can say that answer. Yes, I have read a gospel since I became an adult. There's a level at which we should be ashamed of ourselves, I think, if we're adults who can read and have never read one of the gospels, but we dare to speak about Jesus without having read even one of the gospels. It would take you a night to read one of them, Luke or John. I mean, how can we claim any sort of semblance of being an educated person? Here is the book that has done more transformation in human history than any other book by miles. Right? And yet there are a bunch of people who, for no good reason, have never even read one of the witness accounts, either of John or Luke. That's where the validifying evidence is. People who have been convinced will then write down what it was that persuaded them. But it's a big claim that Jesus makes, and you've got a right to say, I'd like to see some evidence. These guys, I think it's a little dodgy, because they've had plenty. And we're going to see in chapter 11 next week, when Jesus makes one of his most extraordinary and wonderful claims, the response of people who can see that he's done bigger miracles than he's done to this moment, the one that he does in chapter 11. But their only question is, how are we going to kill this bloke? If he keeps doing things like this, everyone's going to follow him. We need help to not hate the light. But God will give us that as well. C.S. Lewis makes the wonderful point, I'm sure you've heard a number of times in various situations. He says, look, the one thing we can't do with Jesus is just say he's a good man. That's just not an option. Right? He says, I'll read you the end of this quite famous quote. He said, either this man was and is the Son of God, or else he's a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come up with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He's not left that open to us, and he did not intend to. But we need to have a look at the validifying evidence. So Jesus makes a huge claim. They ask an understandable challenge. Validify that. And then in the end, Jesus draws their attention to the fact that they, and secondarily ourselves, are caught in an unavoidable crisis. The crisis is, our word crisis comes from the Greek word that turns up a number of times in John's Gospel. It's in verse 16. It's the Greek word that's translated into our English as judgment. A crisis is a moment of judgment where a critical decision has to be made. You are a fork in the road, and these guys have to make a judgment. And Jesus urges them, as he does in chapter 7, for goodness sake, make it a valid judgment about me and not an invalid judgment. But there's a point at which we need to either follow Jesus or fight with him or fly from him. The call in Jesus is to follow him, isn't it? Verse 12, Jesus spoke again to the people. He said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Why does Jesus use the picture of following him here? Remember last week, if you were here, we looked in John 6, where he speaks of himself as being bread, the need to eat him, which is a very weird picture of faith, really engaging with Jesus. Here he uses the word follow. Why? Well, I think, again, it's because it's the picture that the Feast of Tabernacles is all about is the pillar of fire. And the Israelites, if they were going to trust God, how do they show they trusted God? They followed the pillar. Where it went, they went. Even if they didn't understand why they went that way and not that way. They trusted that if God says we're going that way, they're going that way. So the call here for people is to either fight with Jesus or to follow him. And the trouble with following is, all sorts of people follow. We all follow at various points. I follow my guitar teacher. There's many areas of my life where I don't want to be like Hans. But I would like to play the guitar perhaps about a tenth as good as he does. And he wants me to change the place I have my thumb behind, you know. And I'm confused now because it was hard enough trying to confuse these fingers to get them doing the right thing. But now I've got to mess around with the back one. Because I won't bore you, but I've got to... why am I bothering with this? It's slowed me down. My vicious lead riffs are now pathetic. It's because in the end, I know if I don't get the thumb in the right place, I will not be able to play well. Well, I'll probably never play well, but it will not be able to play weller than I am. I am following Hans. I am obeying Hans. If you knew who this guy was, that's such a scary concept. But in this area, he's my teacher. And I'd be a twit not to follow him. I do not know how to play the guitar like he does. You haven't got the faintest clue about life compared to Jesus. What an expert you are on life. We're just mass-produced Australians, which means that we're massively competent. Massively confident, anyhow, in our own view. Jesus knows about God. He's the light about God. Jesus knows about you, what you're made for. Jesus knows about life after death. Jesus knows how to treat your enemy. Jesus knows how to use your money. Right? He's the expert. He's the light in the dark world. The trouble is, it's a swear word, isn't it? In Australia. That's why I didn't want to become a Christian. Because to follow means, I want to use a four-letter swear word, obey. We have to obey Jesus. When the light goes that way, we go that way. Even if everything in our tradition and history and upbringing and says that way. No? If he's going that way, I'm going that way. And I may find myself wandering off, but I'm going to get back. I'm going to follow that pillar of light. Or to use a slightly longer word that's even fouler, to submit ourselves to him. To place ourselves under the light, under his truth and guidance. That is what it is to respond well and wisely to Jesus. And the promise is that when we do that, we'll never walk in the darkness, but we'll have the light of life. I want to finish up by giving you, if I may, a friendly assignment which you can well and truly ignore. And that is this week, why don't you, every time you play with light, think about the difference that light makes to your life. So every time you come into your house and you're trying to find that light switch, just think the difference that light makes. When you turn the light on in the car, the difference it is to have the lights on. When you're on your push bike and you realize, gosh, I've forgotten my light. What difference does that make to your traveling? Just to reflect on what Jesus is on about when he says, I'm the light of the world. If you follow me, you'll never walk in the darkness. That's my suggestion for an assignment for this week, if you've got nothing else to do.
Thanks, Ian. And give you the opportunity now, if you do have a question that you want to write down. Jamie's going to get up, walk through the tables. If you want to just hand that to him, if you want to hand that to him, and then he'll be able to get those up to Ian, and Ian will answer those questions here in a moment. All right, I think that's all of my announcements. I think we turn it back over to you, Ian.
This is a great question. I'm not sure if it's because people's eyes ran to the rest of John 8. How does obedience and freedom come together in one teaching? Obey Jesus, we are free. Please explain. You may know that in the CIA headquarters, and I've seen this in Mission Impossible and other places, so I know it's true. On the big thing on the ground, I think it is, are the words of Jesus. I'd rather they weren't there. It's where it says, the truth will set you free. People think that's just a bit of Western knowledge. It comes up in also the truth. It comes straight out of the mouth of Jesus. It's in John 8 later on in this inflammatory chapter. Jesus says, if you remain in my teaching or hold to my teaching, you're really my disciple. Then you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. John 8:31. And then in verse 36, if the Son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. So you see what Jesus says, if you remain in my teaching. So he says, if you follow me, you'll have light. But then he goes on and says, if you keep following me, if you remain in my teaching, not just make a good start and then forget about him, but keep following. And the way you follow, I take it, is by reading the teaching of Jesus. That's how he directs us. He says, then you'll know the truth. The truth is not known just in the head, according to Jesus, real truth. It's known also, it's shaped and made visible by our willingness to follow. Our will and our heart and our brain all work together in this business, according to Jesus. You'll know the truth, and it's the truth that will set you free. So Jesus' view is only his disciples are free. Now, partly you can think of it in terms of light. If a person is living in a dark world, the smallest obstacle becomes a real threat. How easy it is to walk through this room when the lights are on. How difficult if it's in the dark. And you could compare the fearfulness and the ouchiness of stumbling through a truly dark room with the freedom you have when the lights are on. That's, I think, part of the connection. The other thing I think is, in the end, one of Somerset Maugham's last quotes was, I don't think he meant it in this way, was that a beautiful life is where you live according to your true nature. I think that very sad life, as it came to an end, was really calling us to do whatever we felt like doing. I think that's more what he might have had in mind. But I think there's a truth in it. You live according to your nature. And what are human beings designed? What are you designed for, do you think? We're actually designed in the end for love. I don't want to get all corny and sentimental, but we are actually designed for love. We're designed to be in a loving relationship with the eternal and loving relationships with others, which is why the picture of hell, I think, that is most common in the Bible is the picture of utter aloneness. There's nothing more destructive for a human being. And this was discovered in the Korean War. The North Koreans discovered that the quickest way to break an enemy soldier was not to torture them, but to isolate them. That was more destructive of a person. Long-term solitary confinement where they couldn't even interact with the guards. Right? Freedom is found when you live according to your nature. When is a bird free? See, you put an eagle into the ocean, it ain't going to be free. It's free when it's doing what it's designed to do, which is to fly. A fish is free when it's in the water. Humans are free when we're back where we were designed to be, which is in loving relationship with our Creator and therefore also learning to be in loving relationships with others. That is why freedom is only found by following the light, because that's when you begin to enjoy that loving relationship. So I think the two things are exactly right. You learn to live according to your nature. So I was chatting with two of my daughters yesterday. We had a Lost night. I cooked dinner and then we watched a couple of episodes of Lost, which is lost time, some of you might think, but interesting. But we were talking about a friend, a highly intelligent friend who's got in terrible trouble because he got drunk. And then things followed from that, which have just got him into all sorts of long-term trouble. And I was sharing with the gal, I said, you know, when I wasn't a Christian, one of the reasons I didn't want to become a Christian was I didn't want to stop getting drunk. I couldn't imagine how you could have a good life without getting drunk, like most mass-produced Australians. And when I became a Christian, I stopped getting drunk simply because God said, we're going this way, buddy, and it doesn't involve drunkenness. And I went, rats, okay, I trudged through the wilderness, not very happy. But in the end, I think, man, if there's ever a command that makes sense, so many people die, so many people do terrible things to themselves and others because they disobey. In the end, God's commands are always for our good and only for our good. And that's all they ever are. We mightn't get them. We mightn't know why the light goes left instead of right, but that's how it is. Let me finish with two songs. You'll be glad to know I'm not going to sing them. But there's a very famous song that the Welsh sing at football. And it has nothing to do with the football, but it's a great hymn. But it picks up the pictures that are here in Jesus' teaching. He's talked about the bread last week, referring to the manna. He's talked here about the water in chapter 7, 37. Here he talks about the light, picking up the images that all that Israel focused on, he's saying, it's me. Imagine if Kevin Rudd, if he's still in power next Anzac Day, at Anzac Day stands up and to the whole nation says, you know, Anzac Day, Gallipoli, heroism, courage, Kokoda, Tobruk, you know, all that stuff, he said. You know, all that stuff that we go on about, that's really pointing and all finds its fulfillment and purpose in me. I am the true Anzac. People in the end would be incensed. that he should take the sacred heart of the nation, in a sense. But that is exactly what Jesus is doing. He's taken the sacred heart of Israel. He's going to do it with the Passover in a few weeks' time. This is what Jesus, it's all pointing to me. So here's the hymn. I'm tempted to sing it because it's better when it's sung, but I won't. Guide me, O thou great Jehovah, pilgrim through this barren land. I am weak, but thou art mighty. Hold me with your powerful hand. Bread of heaven, feed me till I want no more. Feed me till I want no more. And then the other one, a Scottish one for those of Celtic origin. I heard the voice of Jesus say, I am this dark world's light. Look unto me and your morn shall rise and all your day be bright. I looked to Jesus and I found in him my star and my sun. And in that light of life I'll walk till travelling days are done. Now that's what it is to be Christian, say. He's the light. I'm going to walk in that till the end of the journey. Thank you. Next week, even better, I think, John 11. Jesus' magnificent statement there about life and resurrection.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.